Okay. So first of all, thank you again to the Sagirs, and also Rav Eli for asking me again. And even though he's not here, I want to thank Yitz Inker for always encouraging me to give this. Before, already a week before Purim, he came over to me after Marv one night and said to me, "So you're getting ready?" I was like thinking, "What, you know, get ready for the Megillah for Purim?" He's like, "You know, for the Haggadah Shiur." So already for many weeks, thank you Yitz for getting me into the Haggadah and prepared for Pesach. Be like, Pesach's coming. Okay, so we'll try and go through quickly 10 ideas, which are really more, but try and get through all of them. As I do every year, I try and find a new Haggadah to... I'll get to that in a second. So this year, the new Haggadah is from Rav Bitterman. I don't know, Rav Avram Elimelech Bitterman. I don't know if any of you have heard of him or seen him. Around Hanukkah time, Ariel Cutler gave me one of these. I don't know if you've seen these people holding this around the yeshuv. So Ariel Cutler gave one to me, and since then I've been... very into his Torah. Apparently, he's a Hasidic Rav in Yerushalayim, the Lulav Hasidim. He's not the Rebbe, but he marbits Torah like crazy and says Divrei Torah. What? Lulav. So that's a lot of the ideas will be coming from him. Oh, you didn't get. Are there any more cheat sheets? Yes. Okay. Okay. So, so the first idea, just a little bit before Pesach, leading into Pesach. So, just about cleaning for Pesach. So, Rav Bitterman tells a story of Rav Shimshon Aaron Polanski, who was a big Talmud Chacham in Europe and then Yerushalayim. Rav Cook, just to give you background, Rav Cook said at the time that Rav Polanski was Talmud Chacham number one in Yerushalayim at the time. That give you, you know, coming from Rav Cook, that's pretty big. So anyway, I don't know, didn't say in the story whether this was in Europe or in Yerushalayim, but Rav Polanski came into the Beis Medrash a few days before Pesach, and he sees a bunch of Vreichim, Kolo guys sitting in the yeshiva, and they're learning, and you know, it's great. So he gets to the bima, and he gives a big clap, and they all look, he's a big Talmud Chacham. And he says, there are a number of almanos, of widows in the community that need help getting ready for Pesach, and I need some volunteers. So everybody, you know, quickly closes their gemara, runs up to the bima, says, "Okay, line up. And they line up, and he gives each of them an envelope, and he says the address of the almana is in the envelope. And so they get it, and they go outside, and they open up the envelope, and each one of them sees that the address is their own home address. He was basically giving them mussar that, you know, you think that you should just leave the cleaning to your wife and or the rest of the family, but cleaning for Pesach is really something which is a family effort and shouldn't be belittled. I mean, he talks a lot about, you know, cleaning for Pesach is a deep idea. It's not just let's get rid of the chametz, the physical, but anyway, so that leads us into this. So just connected to this, and now we already get into the Haggadah, but Rav Bitterman says, the Russia asks, the Russia asks, "Ma havoda azos lachem?" Right? What are you doing here? Like, what? Come on. And what Rav Bitterman says, the Russia is asking, it seems strange, because if the Russia is saying, "What are you doing?" Like, why? I don't want any part of this. He should be asking it at some time else, like at Yom Kippur, when you have to fast, when there's affliction. And like Pesach, we're sitting around the table, we have wine flowing, we've got lots of food, we're comfortable. Like, why Pesach dafka? So Rav Bitterman says it's because the Russia sees leading up to Pesach, his parents yelling and screaming and, "Oh, don't get the chametz in there, what are you doing?" And, you know, and going crazy, and, "Oh, the bills for the groceries are so expensive." And the Russia sees this is the way, you know, this is what it is, like people, you know, the stories from in 100 years ago, or whatever, 75 years ago in America, in Shver Zayin Yid, it's so hard to be a Jew, moaning and groaning. And when the child sees this, that's the child then will say, "Maha Vodah Zos Lachem, I don't want any part of this. If it's so difficult to enjoy the Chag, to have a festival, so then I don't want any part of it." And that's why it's so important leading up to Pesach Rav Bitterman says that in Parshas Kisisa, it says Elohei Maaseicha lo sa'aselach, that you shouldn't these foreign gods you shouldn't make, right? Avodah Zarah. And then the very next pasuk it says Eschag Hamatzos Tishmor. And Rav Bitterman says that in the Gemara, Avodah Zarah is often equated with anger, right? Somebody, like the Gemara says, anybody who's angry is like they're Oved Avodah Zarah. And so what the Pasuk, what Hashem is teaching us, is that leading up to Pesach, it can be very stressful trying to get ready for Pesach. There's a lot to do, but we have to try and go into the holiday b'simcha, b'shalva, calmly, and if we do that, then when we get to Leil HaSeder, then we can really enjoy it, our children can enjoy it, and so that's just the first idea guiding us into Pesach. Okay, number two, Yachatz. So why do we split the matzah? So we've spoken before, I think, about this. It's a famous question, what we do. Let me ask, does anybody here know? Soloveitchik likes to, often says that the best way to understand a word is to look at the first time it's mentioned in the Torah. To understand, I mean, Rosh Hashanah or Hirsch also does this. The etymology of a word is to look at the first time it appears in the Torah. So what's the first place that the word Yachatz, the Shorish Yachatz, appears in the Torah? And, very good, Ravelli. Vayachatz Esav Asher Ito. Yaakov splits the two camps, right? Esav is, he knows that he's going to meet Esav. So Yaakov splits his party into two camps. And so why was he doing that? Because he wanted to protect. He said, Im Yavo Esav, if Esav comes and destroys or Chas V'Shalom kills one of the groups, the other one will be able to get away. And so, right, Beryl Wein in his Haggadah says that throughout history, Hashem has always made it so that there's always one group of the Jewish people that has survived. Right when in Eretz Yisrael the Beis HaMikdash was being destroyed, they were being exiled. You had Bavel as like the center for the Jewish people, and you know throughout history the times when one goes down, you know, you have another. You know, when the Holocaust, then the Jewish community in America was flourishing, and in Israel was starting to grow. You know. So throughout history, Hashem has always made sure that there's one group of the Jewish people that survives and thrives. And that's when we get to Yachatz, when we're breaking it, we're symbolizing the fact that Hashem never leaves us to be completely destroyed, and that He always leaves over a piece or part of the Jewish people for later to continue the Jewish tradition. So when doing that, we can have in mind to thank Hashem that we are still in existence. Number three, Baruch HaMakom, and the four sons. So we say Baruch HaMakom, Baruch Hu, right? We say four times, Baruch Shanas HaTorah L'mo Yisrael, Baruch Hu. So question number one, what's with the four Baruchs? Why are we saying, thank you Hashem, bless Hashem, praise Hashem, four times? So we've said before, again, there's an idea of the number four, but why are we saying Baruch so many times? And furthermore, we say by the four sons, we say Keneged Arba Banim Dibra Torah Echad Chacham VeEchad Rasha VeEchad Tam VeEchad Sheinu Yodei Lishol. Why are we stressing in front of each one Echad? But just say that Torah spoke Keneged the Arba Banim the Chacham Rasha Tam Yoneinu Yodei Lishol. What's the Echad? So I'd like to connect two ideas here. One, several that are found in Rav Bitterman and from Rav Beryl Wein. So Rav Beryl Wein says, what's the Echad? It's because we have to view each one of the children, regardless of who they are and how they're acting, as an echad, as a unique, as an individual, and praise them for who they are as a child. It doesn't matter what they do, it doesn't matter how they act, but each and every single child, right, Ohuba, is special and unique. And if we treat them as an echad, then that's the way that they'll grow and thrive. And Rav Bitterman, in his Haggadah, says that in the Rambam, in Hilchos Tshuva, the Rambam says that you shouldn't think that it's predetermined who's going to be a tzaddik and who's going to be a rasha, but rather everybody has the potential to be a gadol. Everybody has the potential to be kol adam roi lo liyo tzaddik kemoshe rabenu. Everybody has the potential to be a tzaddik like Moshe. And based on this, the Chazon Ish often would say that every single child is a safek gadol hador. You only missed the first two or three years. Mm-hmm. I gave you a shout out in the beginning. So the Chazon Ish often would say that every single child is a safek gadol hador, because every single child has the potential to be Moshe Rabbeinu, a tzaddik like Moshe Rabbeinu, so it's a safek gadol hador. And it's that kind of mindset, thinking about our children not as oh, this is the Rasha, and this is the Chacham, this is the Tam, but each child is an Echad. We view each one as unique and special, and the safek gadol hador, then they will feel that way. They will, the way that we treat them, that's how they are. And just in terms of giving them this positive encouragement, Rav Bitterman quotes from Rav Chaim Ibrisk. Rav Chaim Ibrisk says that every single child is like a plant. And just like a plant needs nourishment, what's the nourishment? It's water. You water the plant grows. So too a child needs to be watered and showered with praise, with positive encouragement and positive reinforcement. And I don't remember if I've said this before, maybe. I looked through my old notes, I didn't see it, so if I said it, it was extemporaneously at an old shir. But I think it may have been in Yitz's house, if it was. My wife's first advisor when she was an OT in Washington Heights at the Birch School, Deborah Natali, said to her that if positive reinforcement was rain, then the earth would be a desert, because unfortunately, especially in this generation, people are more quick to point out negative things that people are doing rather than focusing on the positive and giving that positive encouragement. And if we could only shower our children with the baruch, and that's why I think perhaps before we talk about our babanim, we have to remind ourselves, the Baal HaGa is reminding us that we have to be, we can't be stingy on the praise. We have to, with a baruch, 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 we remind ourselves the importance of praising others, praising Hashem, praising the children. Okay, number four. So now into the meat of the Haggadah, right, which we often try and go through quickly, just stating the Pesukim, so let's focus on it here for a minute. So we have in Parsha Shmos, the beginning of Parsha Shmos, Paro says, the Jewish people are going to multiply and be numerous, and are going to come against us like our enemies. So Hava nitchach malo pen yirbeva yakitikren mechamav no saf kam hual so nimnu v'neocham banu v'alamin haaretz. But what does Paro say? Paro says pen yirbe. Right, lest the Jewish people increase, so we're gonna afflict them, and they won't be able to multiply and have lots of children. And what actually ends up happening? V'chasher ya'anu oso kein yirbe v'chein yipros. That as much as the Egyptians would afflict them, it was almost like the frog in Machas Fardeh. The more they hit the frog, the more it multiplied. The more they afflicted the Jewish people, you know, they were multiplying six at a time and maybe 60 at a time, according to the Radak. They say, okay, well, most people don't say that. But in any event, they were multiplying. Kain yirbe. But if you look at Rashi says, what's this kain and the pen yirbe, kain yirbe? Rashi says, Ruach HaKodesh Omer is kain. Atem omrim pen yirbe, v'ani omer kain yirbe. Hashem is saying, Paro, you think pen yirbe, that you're, you know, that maybe that I'm going to prevent them from doing it. I'm saying, no, they are going to increase. You're going to say, pen yirbe, I'm not going to let them increase. I'm going to say, yes, they are going to increase. But Rav Bitterman, and I think this is a Hasidic idea, I've seen it quoted by a few different people, says, if you read it, you have to read it a little bit differently. Say, Paro was saying, I am going to pen yirbe. I am going to increase the pen. Pen can also be representative of doubt, of suffolk. And Paro is saying, what's the way to put Jewish people down and make them feel despair and like there's no hope? Is by creating suffolk. And think about it in our own lives, when we have suffolk in our lives, right? Should I buy this or shouldn't I buy this? Should I invite these people for Shabbos for a meal or shouldn't I? Should I send my child to school A or school B? It's very stressful, and it like sort of weighs on you, and you know, until you make a decision. Once you make a decision, so then it's like a weight's lifted off you. Like the Gemara says, "Ein simcha keheter asfekos." That true joy is when you have no more suffake, no more doubt. When you figured out what to do. And so Paro was saying, how can I afflict the Jewish people the most? By creating suffake in their lives, by doubt. And the Jewish people say, "What? If things were so good, what happened? All of a sudden now we're being afflicted, and what happened? Where's Hashem?" They have suffake, they have doubt in their lives. And Hashem says, "Paro, you think you're going to give them suffake? I'm going to give the Jewish people kain yirbeh. I'm going to increase their kain, increase their emuna, and their belief in their vada'ut, that they and eventually their simcha." And that's something that we can take going into the Leil HaSeder. And Leil HaSeder is a time of emuna. It's a time when we can say we no longer have doubt. I think I spoke about this last year. It's a Leil HaEmuna. It's a time where all questions are answered. So that's the Paro said, "Kain pen your bed." Hashem is telling us, "No, kain your bed." That the night of the Seder, we'll remove all doubts and through emuna in Hashem, that removes doubt. Okay, number five. Okay, in Makas Choshech. So we know in Makas Choshech, Rashi tells us based on the Nechilta that 80% of the Jewish people died. And he saw you were asking about this last week. 80% of the Jewish people died in Makas Choshech. So let me ask you a question. I never thought of this until I saw this Rabbirman his packet on Parshas Bo. He quotes the Rush. What happened to Dasan and Aviram? Were Dasan and Aviram good people? I mean, I've always thought of them as sort of troublemakers and, you know, wicked Rishayim. But what happened? They were saved. You know, what happened? Why didn't they die in Makas Choshech when 80% of the Jewish people, all the Rishayim, that's the time when the Rishayim, the wicked Jews in Egypt died. So why didn't Dasan and Aviram also die at that time? So the Rush says it must be that Dasan and Aviram had emuna in Hashem. Whoever had emuna in Hashem, even if they weren't the best of the best Jews, but if they had emuna in Hashem, then they were saved. I mean, that the whole Chag of Pesach is the time of emuna. And so if they had emuna in Hashem, then they were saved. And Reb Biderman says that it just goes to show you that you don't have to be the best person in the world. I mean, we all have our faults. But if we have emuna, that's the most important thing, is that we have emuna in Hashem, and that no matter how dark and bleak things may seem, whether it be something difficult in our lives or that we feel like there's no hope for us, if Dasan and Aviram were able to have emuna regardless of their flaws, then even we can be saved from our own personal Makas Choshech in our lives. And how are we doing on time here? All right. So I remember a few months ago, Dov Lippman sent out a video of a soccer player from Yerushalayim soccer team, and he scored a goal. He wasn't wearing a kippah. He ran over to the stands, grabbed the kippah, put it on his head, and said Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. And I remember after seeing that, like, the next week I was talking with some Israelis about different things, and we started talking about I shared with them this story, and I said, as an Israeli, maybe you don't realize this, but a lot of Israelis that are not religious at all, they have more emuna than some of the more religious people in the rest of the world. And it's just, sometimes we get this, we have this preconceived notion, and we can't put people in boxes, and really, you know, emuna is something that's so important that regardless of where you are in life and what you're doing, if you have emuna, that it can really, you know, propel you forward. So it's something just to keep in mind. If Dasan Aviram could be saved, then we can all be saved from our personal Makas Choshech. Okay, number six, Dayenu. Rebbe Wein asks, many Meforshim ask about all the different Dayenus. What do you mean if you'd only, you know, done this Hashem, then it would have been enough? And so Rebbe Wein says about If you had only brought us to Har Sinai, not given us the Torah, Dayenu. What do you mean? How could it be if we didn't get the Torah, Dayenu? Like, how could that be? So Rabbi Berel Wine says that based on the Rashi that says, Vayichan Sham Yisrael Neged HaHar, that when the Jewish people came before Kabbalah Satorah, they were united. They had that Achdus. They were treating each other. V'ahavta l'reacha kamocha. So Zeh Klal Gadol B'Torah, right? According to Hillel, that you learn V'ahavta l'reacha kamocha, you've learned the whole Torah. Rabbi Kiva Zeh Klal Gadol B'Torah. So at this point, they'd already received the Torah Kilu. If they've got that one down, then it's like they've already learned the Torah, and everything else is pratim. But I wanted to add to that we see in other places. We've talked about this before also. I put here the Sfas Emes, the importance of Achdus, and that unity really is something which can be a salvation for the Jewish people. Like we saw last month with the Megillah, that the Jewish people were when they had unity, then they were able to be saved from Haman. And we said a few years ago, the Sfas Emes says, "Vihi she'amda shelo echad bilvad amar aleinu chaloseinu." When we don't have echad, when we don't have Achdus, so then the Jewish people are a danger. But when we have unity, so then Hashem saves us. So that, you know, perhaps that even the fact that we had unity at that point, even if we didn't get the Torah, the fact that we had the unity, it was already enough for Hashem to be able to say, okay, I will save you later points in history. Okay, number 7, matzah. Rav Soloveitchik, this is in the Night That Unites Haggadah, Rav Soloveitchik says that he compares the three stages of baking matzah to the three stages of a person's life. He says that the three stages of a person's life, there's the early childhood, the teenage years, and adulthood. And he compares that to the lisha, the kneading of the matzah, which, you know, the matzah is very pliable at that point. You have the baking of the matzah, which it's starting to form more, it's a little bit harder to shape. And then finally, the krimat panim, which is the, you know, when it starts to get darker. And at that point, it's really pretty difficult to try and change the matzah and to change a person. And so Rav Soloveitchik says that, that's really when we try and get rid of chametz and prevent the matzah from becoming chametz and shmura matzah, you know, already from the beginning stages, is because it's so important, you know, with our children as well, to try and protect them and shelter them and really keep them shamur from being affected by the negative things in this world. Okay, number 8. Okay, karpas. Okay, so also in the same Haggadah, Shlomo Karpas says, why do we dip the karpas in the salt water? So he says because the salt water is right. The salt water reminds us of the tears, and he says it's not just enough to remember the tears, but we want to internalize the tears, internalize the suffering and the crying, in order to leave a lasting impression. And so, Rav Binderman has a story about the Panovich Rav, I think this the story happened maybe a few months ago. Some of the stories in here are Borkhorns. It's not just only old stories. Maybe you've seen that. I know you don't see Rav Binderman? Okay. So he has a story in there that there was somebody that came to Baal Tshuva Yeshiva, a 70-year-old man came to Baal Tshuva Yeshiva in Yerushalayim, and he knocked on the door one night, and the Rosh Yeshiva answers and says, you know, what are you doing here? He said, well, I want to be Chozer B'Tshuva. So he says, well, you know, I'm sorry to ask this, but, like, you're already 70. Like, you know, I mean, what happened earlier? You know, why are you waiting until now to come to learn? So he said, let me tell you a story. When I was a little boy, my father was killed in the Holocaust, and my mother and I came from Europe to Eretz Yisrael. And because of everything that happened, my mother gave up on Yiddishkeit and Torah and mitzvos. And when we came, so she sent me to one of the orphanages, the schools to go to, and it happened to be the Panovich Yeshiva. They also had a home or whatever for young children, but she didn't know. And so he's there, and she came to visit the first day, and she sees where he is, and she says, forget this, you know, you're coming home. She packs him up and brings him home. When the Panovich Rav hears about what happened, he comes to their house, and he tries to plead with her and to discuss with her, and she says, you don't understand what I went through, and there's no way, no how, he's not going back. So the Panim Vitcher Rav says, can I please have a chair? So he sits down. He starts bawling, crying for 10 minutes. And he stops, he gets up, he says thank you, and he leaves. And for all these years, this 70-year-old man says, for all these years, those tears, that crying from the Panovich Rav stayed with me. It's haunted me until today when finally I said, that's it, I can't stand this anymore. I need to come back. I need to learn more Torah and mitzvos and see what I was missing all these years. And so I think that it fits very nicely with Shlomo Karlbach, that we need to internalize the crying, the tears of Mitzrayim, the tears of the Jewish people, but in general, internalize the tears and suffering of others. Okay, we're running out of time, so we'll just go through these last two quickly. So Shvoch Amascha, so when we open up the door, so let me ask you, if I had, oh, you already looked at the cheat sheet, forget it. It's a trouble with the cheat sheet. Okay, so there are many different reasons given why we open the door at Shvoch Amascha. The most famous is probably for Eliyahu, right? It's Eliyahu is coming. Also famous, the Rama says, because it's Leil Shimurim, so we want to show that Hashem protects us, so we open up the door. Some other less famous reasons, maybe, it's because we're checking to make sure there's no government official listening, that we're going to say, oh, the government's terrible, we're going to kill you, Shvoch Hamas. Maybe that's what we're saying. So, you know, make sure there's nobody's listening behind the door, or to make sure that sometimes they would leave non-Jewish blood or a non-Jewish baby on the doorstep to start a pogrom. Shmuel Razovsky says it's because they used to lock the doors so people couldn't go out of the house when they were eating the Karban Pesach, because it has to be eaten in that house, and only afterwards, and then when they went off to the roofs to say Hallel, so then they would open the doors at this time. So in the Sefer HaMinhagim, he brings an interesting minhag that actually in Libya, they used to keep the doors closed the whole Pesach. They wouldn't invite guests, and I mean, if you want, I can send you the article. But basically, he said he connects it to in Spain, that the Christians used to throw rocks in the late 1200s. That they would throw rocks at the Jews, and on the first day of Pesach and on Good Friday, and somehow that minhag. So then all the Jews went into their homes and closed their doors up, and so somehow that minhag, a lot of the people from there seemed to have come to Libya, and so that minhag somehow evolved into keeping their door closed, not inviting people into their homes on Pesach. So there are some people that actually don't open their door. So if you ever see that, don't think. I mean, it's whatever. Okay, finally, just to close, so Hallel Nirtza. So I was just thinking about this the last few days. You know, there's two things that, you know, we try and involve the kids a lot. We do a lot of things to get them excited and engage them. And then also at the end of the Seder, we sing lots of songs, and we sort of end on an upbeat note. And I never really thought about this until the last few days, but then I remembered something I had read a few months ago. There's a book that actually hasn't come out yet by Dan and Chip Heath. If you've heard the book Made to Stick, they also wrote that book. They wrote several other books, and because I'm on their email list, they sent me a pre-copy of their newest book that talks about, what's it called? Making Moments Count. And it's about different ways and things that make, what makes a moment memorable. And so in towards the beginning, they talk about how psychologists actually refer to something as the peak-end rule. And that the best or worst moment, meaning the peak or the ending, are what's most important in terms of somebody remembering a certain moment or a certain thing that happened. Just to give you an example, the Heath brothers talk about, let's say you're going to Disney World with your family, and so if you have many different peaks during the day of things that happen, so let's say in the morning, 9 a.m., you're going out of the hotel, there's excitement in the air, the kids are excited, so if you rated it, it would be a 6. And then an hour later, you're riding on It's a Small World together, and it's okay, it would be a 5. And then an hour later, they're rushing through Space Mountain roller coaster. It's amazing. The kids want to ride it again. They'd rate that a 10. And then they're eating lunch in one of the themed restaurants in the park, and the kids are enjoying it. It's a 7. And then an hour later, everybody's waiting in line. It's 100 degrees outside. Everybody's getting anxious and upset and antsy, and that would be a 3. And then at the very end of the day, as they're leaving, you buy Mickey Mouse ears and you put them on the kids. They look so cute. They had such a good day. That would be an 8. So if you would take an average of all of those, it would come out to 6.5, which is pretty good. But if you would ask those same people a week later to rate their overall Disney experience, so we'd expect them to reflect on the experience to be pretty similar and also give about an average of 6.5. But what the psychologists say is, based on this peak end rule, is that really your overall rating would be a 9, because the research recalls that the research says that in recalling the experience, we ignore most of what happened and focus instead on a few particular moments. And so those two moments of Space Mountain and buying the mouse ears, the Mickey Mouse ears, are what's going to stand out because those are peak moments, and that's the end moment, which are so memorable. And it's going to be the average of that 8 and the 10, which is 9, as opposed to the average of the whole experience. When we're thinking about the Seder, that's what we're doing, right? We're trying to make peak moments, memorable moments throughout the Seder, doing crazy things, you know. It doesn't even have to be what the Baal Haggadah tells us to do, of lifting up the cups of wine or the matzah. It could even just be, I was thinking this year, maybe just putting like a different colored napkin at each place. Just, whatever, different things to get the kids interested. And then what do we do at the very end? We end on a high note with Hallel and Yirtzah singing and festive and happy, and because that's the peak end rule. That if you want to make it memorable, then you have to raise those peaks and you have to make the end memorable. And so hopefully, this year at Seder and in the future, that our children, our families, ourselves, that it won't just be another Seder, another year of Pesach, but it'll be a memorable Pesach, Ezra Hashem, opening the door that we will actually see Eliyahu Mashiach coming to tell us that Mashiach is on his way.